yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, as promised last week, the subject today is financial bubbles revisited. In particular, we want to look again at stocks, at junk bonds, and at bitcoins. Okay, why is the stock market rising to bubble levels? And what are some of the other key bubbles that are beginning to grow, and they are, elsewhere, not only in the U.S., but globally as well? Well, why do prices of any financial asset rise? Well, the reason is the demand for that asset. You see, financial assets as products or commodities are fundamentally different than real goods and service prices. Well, what's the big difference? Well, in my book, Systemic Fragility and Global Economy, in 2016, I explained how they are different. And one of the big differences is that financial assets are driven largely by demand for them. And, of course, the demand for the assets is driven by the availability of credit. And credit, of course, is the result of liquidity generated by the central banks, which has been massive, especially since 2000, but also non-money forms of credit, like margin debt buying and so forth. You know, you can, from a broker, you can buy more of your stock or any stock you wish, is simply because the value of your existing holdings rises in price. So they allow you to buy on margin. So that's pure credit. And in this world of financialization and technology-driven and shadow banks, more and more of this non-money form of credit is being made available to investors and speculators, as well as this massive increase made possible in more traditional forms of money by the central bank. So we got money-based credit and non-money-based credit both accelerating, and with that great amount of liquidity, you have professional investors investing more in stocks and financial assets. And of course, the more demand you have, because now you have credit rising with which to purchase the financial asset, the stock, with the more demand, the price goes up. So we have speculative demand significantly driving the stock market. Okay, there are fundamental reasons behind demand and supply, which we're not going to get into. Supply and demand are not the ultimate causes. It's what drives supply and demand. So they're kind of like intermediary causes. But let's work with supply and demand as explanations for these runaway bubble, near bubble financial asset prices and markets. And, you know, some of them are more obvious than others right now. The U.S. stock market, of course, is very much in bubble territory. The prices, the price earnings, and the price value of U.S. stocks are at their highest level since 1929. They're almost approximating the 1999-2000 tech bubble. The tech prices are about the same as they were at the bubble in 1999-2000. And we know that led to the dot-com tech bust and the recession of 2001, which was only offset at the mid-level of that recession by significant government spending as a result of the 9/11 crisis. Okay, so we're almost there where we were before and only second to 1929. So what's driving demand and prices in U.S. stocks, the S&P 500, the Dow, and the NASDAQ? Well, a number of forces, and they're all liquidity, debt leverage, debt leveraging that is fundamentally behind it all. Okay, so what's enabling the massive liquidity that's behind this runaway purchasing of stock values, prices, right? Well, first of all, we have the Federal Reserve. As I mentioned, the Federal Reserve kept interest rates virtually zero for banks and not much higher for professional investors and shadow banks that borrow from the banks. You see, the commercial banks go to the Federal Reserve and they borrow almost free money, and then they loan it to the shadow banks, and which are investment bankers and private equity and hedge funds and so forth. The shadow banks borrow from the banks, and the banks borrow the money virtually free from the Federal Reserve. I can hardly call it borrowing, because for 8 years it was like 0.1%. Banks could go borrow. And then the Federal Reserve, on top of that, not only loaned money to banks to loan to shadow banks and investors, it went out and purchased directly the bad assets, subprime mortgages and so forth, from banks, shadow banks, and private investors even, on a subsidized basis, in other words, above market value. It bought back these bad assets and turned over this liquidity once again to investors. So the central bank, pumped a lot of direct liquidity into the economy through the banks and directly through quantitative easing, as we called it. Okay. Well, that drove down interest rates in the U.S. to record low levels, not just the federal funds rate that the central bank, the Federal Reserve, affects, which is the benchmark rate, but it drove down all other interest rates, including for corporate bonds. So in addition to the direct liquidity flow from the central banks, you get this very, very low interest rates, and corporations just issued record levels of corporate bonds and raised money that way as well. And then they made these massive profits along the way, non-financial and financial corporations. Profits doubled and tripled. So earnings from squeezing wages and reducing benefits and so forth as well, earnings, corporate earnings, profits accelerated. And the tax cuts allowed them, under Bush and Obama, allowed them to keep most of it. And we're seeing even another round of tax cuts going on. Right? So, in short, three sources here. The central bank pumping liquidity into investors and the financial markets. And the secondary effect of low interest rate and corporate bond issuance. And then huge profits as well. And if you were an offshore multinational corporation, the massive liquidity injections had the effect of reducing the value of the dollar, which boosted the profits of multinationals offshore. That's why they went offshore so much and took a lot of their borrowings and pumped them into developing economies rather than the U.S. So, the confluence of all this, record profits and free money and low dollar and low interest rates, resulted in this massive money liquidity overhang in the economy. Well, what are they going to do with all that money, right? Far more liquidity and money and credit than they needed to invest in real assets, real things, real plant and equipment and buildings in the U.S. far more money hanging around. And as I said, a lot of that money investment in real things went offshore anyway because the profitability was even greater there. So that's why we got a slow recovery in the U.S. Not much went into real things, making real things, hiring real people. And the changes in the labor markets at the same time allowed them to hire real people, more part-time, contingent contract basis, and not pay health care and pensions and so forth. So profit margins were fattened as well in the whole process. So all this massive money hanging around went into financial asset markets, into the stock markets. It was further stimulated by the practice of corporations being so flush with cash, buying back their stocks and paying out dividends at record levels since 2008. So, you know, on top of it, the money and the liquidity they generated, they just turned around and pumped it back into the market and drove stock prices even higher. Well, how much did they pump back into the market? Stock buybacks since 2008, just by the S&P 500 largest corporations, just the 500 largest corporations, over $4 trillion in buybacks in 2015-16. You know, like $600 billion, right? So a total of $4 trillion since 2008, and now this year, according to Goldman Sachs research, another $570 billion in stock buybacks, and next year the forecast is for $590 billion in stock buybacks. Well, that's demand for stocks, which drives up the price. It's kind of like a second follow-on, knock-on effect of liquidity rolling back into driving up stock prices. And it's not just that was the problem, not just stock buybacks. Well, what else is it? Dividend payouts. Massive dividend payouts at the very same time going on as stock buybacks. Well, how much? Over $400 billion a year. So you got about $600 billion in stock buybacks and over $400 billion in dividends. That's $1 trillion every year, virtually since 2008-2009, going back into stock market and into other financial assets, dividends, you know, and some of it's hoarded, but a massive amount, almost $1 trillion a year. Well, that's going to drive up the price of stocks, isn't it? And, of course, other financial assets, derivatives, we don't know how much went there. But that's what drove and is continuing to drive the profits and the prices of the three main stock markets in the U.S. And, you know, not all that money went into U.S. stock markets. Some of it went into offshore equity markets as well. A recent report by Yardeni Research just came out here, in fact, yesterday, indicates that 91% of corporate operating earnings, 91% are going into stock buybacks and dividend payouts. 91%. Another study, I forget the source, 66% of corporate earnings, that's total earnings last year, went into buybacks and dividend payouts. And operating earnings, of course, are a subset of corporate earnings. But operating earnings is from, you know, things you sell and the cost of selling them. All right, 91% flowing back into buybacks and dividends. This has never, ever happened in the history of U.S. capitalism, you see. And it's all part of what I had described in my Systemic Fragility book as basically, you know, an indication of the financialization of investing and financialization of the economy in the 21st century in the U.S. I have a different definition of financialization than most. It's not just simply employment in finance sector or profits in finance sector. It's based on the expansion of the shadow banking system and its increasing dominance over commercial banking, and the new global finance capital elite and their economic and political power that seems to be growing. Of course, there are new markets they create for new financial securities that they create. And this is where all this excess money is flowing. Not all, but a great part of it, right? They're living off finance. They're not making money by making things and services. They're making money from money. That's what it is. It's money from money. Using money to make money rather than using money and credit to make things. That's the fundamental change that's going on here, okay? So record corporate profits and lead to the stock buybacks and the dividend payouts after the Fed pumps all this money and credit into the system, and we end up with far more credit and money than even necessary to purchase to invest in real goods, you know, capital accumulation of various kinds, real capital or gross private domestic investment, as we would call it, and corporate bond issuance as a result, a secondary result of the very low interest rates created by the Federal Reserve, the central bank. Companies like Apple will borrow billions, tens of billions, and use it to pay back and buy back stocks rather than taking its cash hoard of $268 billion and using that to make payments to stockholders, shareholders, you see. They borrow the money because it's so cheap. So the liquidity is not just the profits. The liquidity is profits plus issuance of debt, corporate debt, as well. So that massive liquidity is funding the ever-rising stocks, you see. Institutional investors now are 80% of the market. And many of them are high risk takers, and they're chasing yield and driving up the market in order to earn it. The market itself has changed. The stock markets have changed. And this is also exacerbating the trend of ever-rising stock prices. Well, how has it changed? We have this significant shift underway in just recent years from what's called active investing to passive investing. What's passive investing? Well, it's the creation of exchange-traded funds indexing, mutual funds indexing. Investors who aren't the main professional shadow bank institutional investors, we sometimes call them retail investors, what have they been doing? They've been investing in ETFs and passive indexes. $3 trillion, the market is for ETFs is now $3 trillion. From less than a trillion just a few years ago. What are ETFs? ETFs are a fund of stocks or a fund of bonds and so forth that is linked, indexed to the general market trend, price trend. Okay, so ETFs will rise as the general market rises. And because it does so, it generates a further rise in the general market, you see. And passive indexing is the same thing. Now, the problem with ETFs and passive indexing is that once the downturn occurs, it's going to exacerbate and accelerate the contraction of the stock prices. Paul Singer of Elliott Management, you know, the big hedge fund private equity guy, big shadow banker, multi-billionaire, one of the richest, perhaps, has recently said that ETFs are devouring capitalism. That's a quote. ETFs are devouring capitalism, unquote. Yeah. Active trading, funds in active trading have been declining at a rapid rate. Right now, only 10% of all the trading volume in the stock market is active trading. 90% is indexing, according to Carlyle Research, another big shadow bank. Automated trading. It's automated, you see. ETFs, you'll buy more because the market's rising, and that drives the market up. Same with index funds, called passive investing. And this will result in outsized market price contractions in a crisis, just as it is now resulting in outsized market price increases, driving the market up. Big risk. ETFs are the subprime mortgages of the next crisis. Okay, so ETFs, these changes in passive indexing and investing, are also driving the stock market up. Right? We also have, because the dollar is low, and policymakers are keeping it low, globally here, we have foreign speculators also bringing money into the U.S. You see, if their investments are offshore, because U.S. capital moves into these emerging markets and allows it to expand. You know, EME debt is also at record levels. EME, emerging market economies, at record levels. So their profits are debt-driven, but the profits are still there up until now. And investors in the emerging markets take their profits and they send them to the U.S., into the U.S. stock market, which is rising. Safer bet than their own stock markets, which are more volatile. So that demand, that money inflow, drives demand in the stock markets as well, U.S. stock markets. Now, we're not through yet. There's other forces here at play. The animal spirits, as the economist Keynes called them, have been released by Trump. Real investment was declining in the U.S. dramatically. But now, the cash that was on the side, even more of it's being released because of Trump. Well, how is Trump responsible for that? And some of it's going into the real economy as well for the first time. Investors in anticipation of greater profitability coming in 2018 are committing more of their money capital to investment now over the past 9 months. Investment partly in financial assets in the stock market and partly into real business investment as well for the first time in years. But it's all in anticipation, you see, in expectation that it will result in more profits. Whether it does or not remains to be seen, but certainly they know that there will be more profitability because of cuts in corporate and business operating expenses and cuts in general corporate costs. You see, if you reduce corporate costs, you ipso facto increase retained earnings and profitability. So corporations and businesses in the U.S. see the policies followed by Trump as the source of immediate and intermediate significant increase in earnings and profitability. Well, where is this coming from? In the case of Trump, the tax cuts, big cuts in corporate costs as a result of the tax cuts. As I've said before, we talked on the show about the Trump tax cuts last week, week before, and we will return to that theme next week when the Senate version of the Trump cuts are clarified. $1.5 trillion in tax cuts for corporate businesses alone, and another roughly $700 billion for non-corporate businesses through the pass-through provision. You're talking about over $2 trillion in cuts in costs and thus increase in retained earnings, profitability, by businesses in the U.S. Well, in anticipation of this, they're investing in both stocks, financial assets, as well as some of it in real assets. Now, this isn't the only source of cuts in costs, corporate costs, promised by Trump here. And by the way, Trump said that corporate provision, $1.5 trillion, is his number one priority. So you see really where he's coming from here. You know? Let me digress just a little bit on this tax thing before we get back to our analysis of the stock market and why it just keeps rising. The tax cuts. I've written recently a piece called The Trump-Ryan $4.6 trillion tax cut. You keep hearing in the press, and Democrats, even Elizabeth Warren, keep saying, oh, it's a $1.5 trillion tax cut. No, a tax hike, rather. No, it's not. It's a $4.5 trillion tax hike, $3 trillion paid for, a hike, in other words, on the middle class alone. $3 trillion. Just in the eliminating the personal exemptions and the tax itemization, tax deductions, and a few other items, education, ending education credits and environmental credits, that's $3 trillion in tax hikes. You know, it's not a $1.5 trillion tax bill. It's a $4.5 trillion tax bill. And the difference, the $1.5 trillion, is because tax cuts, $4.5 trillion, at least, to corporations and the wealthy 1%. In other words, they're taxing the middle class, $3 trillion, and they're giving $4.5 trillion to corporations, businesses, and the wealthy 1%. So you have a net loss that'll hit the U.S. deficit and budget of $1.5 trillion. It's not a $1.5 trillion package. You know, it's a $4.5 trillion and more. Even the New York Times estimated more. Here yesterday, their estimation came out. So why are we talking about a $1.5 trillion tax deal when that's only the part they got to come up with in the deficit? And I'll tell you how they're going to come up with it. Following immediately after this will be a cut in social spending. That's how they're going to make up. You know, they're going to take a bigger whack at Medicare and education. And Trump has already signaled this by saying he wants to, after the tax cut, go after welfare spending, you see. Social Security is welfare to these guys. Okay, so, you know, the importance of the tax cuts is that it fattens the bottom line of corporations, and then they pass it on through stock buybacks and dividend payouts, $1 trillion a year, to their shareholders, you see. That's the way it works. But it's not just tax cuts that are going to reduce corporate costs and business costs. The massive deregulation that's been going on from day one under the Trump administration also reduces costs. And now they're going after the trying to repeal the individual mandate for the ACA, Obamacare, taking another whack at that. Well, once they repeal that, and it looks like the Senate may agree to that, they will reduce the investment tax hike that existed at 3.8% on investment income under the ACA. You see, that's really what they were targeting all along. Everything else was a facade. The real objective, why the Koch brothers and others hated Obamacare, was that 3.8% tax, and they were going to eliminate that tax by eliminating the money, $800 billion for Medicaid, you see. But they failed in that. Now they're taking another whack at that. All right, so tax cuts and deregulation and ACA are all examples of fiscal subsidization by government of corporations and investors. But that's not the only reduction in cost. By keeping the dollar low, the value of the dollar low, it ensures that multinational corporations offshore are going to keep making fat profits. You know, they make the profits in the local currency, and then they exchange it into lower-cost dollars, and they bring it back to their headquarters in the U.S. So exchange rates, currency exchange rates, the value of the dollar low and the value of the other currencies offshore higher, fattens corporate profits. All of this is relatively immediate. You know, the deregulation, the tax cuts, the lower dollar, all of that investors see as forthcoming immediately from Trump, and that stimulates their animal spirits to invest. And as I said, a good part of it goes into financial markets. Longer term, they see increased profitability from Trump policies in two ways. One, infrastructure spending, which may or may not occur, but I think it will at some point, because it will be very much commercial real estate oriented, and that will prop up that particular sector in particular, which of course is where Trump comes from, you see. And the trade renegotiations going on by Trump. Trump is a free trader, but he's a bilateral free trader. He's not in favor of these multilateral deals because he thinks and he believes, and his business followers believe, now is the time to renegotiate these deals to the better advantage of American capitalists. And that's what this is all about. You know, it takes the false argument that this is about getting rid of free trade and bringing jobs back, then no jobs are coming back under Trump. Right. This is just a way of fooling people once again, and using it as a way for to renegotiate free trade deals on a bilateral basis. Okay, so to sum up, animal spirits are being released to invest even further in financial markets because corporations foresee greater profitability from the tax cuts, from the deregulation, from the ACA repeal, from the low dollar, and then longer term from infrastructure spending and trade renegotiations. All this is going to fatten corporate profits. And then they will pass it through with buybacks and dividend payouts, and shareholders will get to keep more because it's not only a 20% from 35 to 20% tax cuts for their corporations, but we will have a personal income tax, corporate rates reduced as well. So shareholders will keep more and they'll invest more. Assumption, right? Okay, so that's driving the stock market as well. You know, one thing about the stock market is it's a strange market in that we haven't seen the normal corrections of 10-20%. It just keeps going up and up. Well, it's going up and up because the money funding it from the central bank on down just keeps flowing. And because it's becoming institutionalized, professional investors are driving the whole market, and the non-professionals are dumping their money into ETFs and passive indexing. So the professional investors are driving the market, and they have to keep moving their money. And whenever a normal correction is about to occur and starts, the prices retreat a little bit, and it's viewed as a profit-making opportunity, and they pump the money back in, and it goes right back up and keeps climbing again. professional investing, you see, is what these markets are all about now. Professionals, institutionals, hedge funds, private equities, you know, those boutique banks, all that, right? Asset management funds and so forth. That's what's driving the market now. And they're just taking all these dividends and operating earnings and pumping it back into the markets. A little bit is flowing over into real assets now, real asset investing, but not very much, just a little bit. Another factor that's driving now our market is expectations of a global recovery. You know, global animal spirits have been released here a little bit too, in Japan and in Europe as a result of what appears to be the lead of the U.S., into these new areas of subsidization. And, of course, margin debt is at a record level in the stock markets as well. Margin debt where you can borrow money just based on the valuation. Well, you're not even borrowing money. You're just getting credit in order to buy more stock, you see. Margin debt is once again at record highs, and that's driving the stock market too, you see. And China is largely responsible for this recent global recovery. But China now is warning it's going to pull back, slow back, and try to bring its financial speculators under control once again. China historically, since 2010, has been fighting this on-and-off battle with its shadow bankers and speculators, creating bubbles there. And it was hands off of these guys while the Chinese Communist Party was about to hold its conference here. And now that it's held the conference, it's announced that they're going to try to retract some of the liquidity by and go after some of the speculators. They won't have much success in that. You know, this has been a repeat third and fourth time here, and each time they try to do so, they get defaults and risk of defaults and some state-owned enterprises and so forth, and they have to retreat. And there's some signs they're already retreating here. All of this results in what's sometimes called irrational exuberance, a phrase that was coined back in the late 90s, 1999 or thereabouts, by a very good economist at Yale University, Robert Shiller, who warned of the housing bubble and the dot-com bubble at the time. Irrational exuberance means money chasing money in financial assets and just driving up bubbles, you see. Once again, the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, has just issued a warning this past week of increasing signs of irrational exuberance. Once again, you know, this is a catchphrase for speculative fever going on and reaching a peak perhaps here fairly soon. The Bank of America Merrill Lynch did a survey, and it shows that 48% of professional investors believe that stocks are significantly overvalued, and nearly 48%, 42%, that said that price contraction is coming. 48% in this survey is higher than it was on the eve of the dot-com bust in 2000. Yeah, right on the eve of that, 48% today is even higher. Just this past year, the tech-heavy NASDAQ stock, U.S. stock market, has increased over 25%. The price level has risen over 25% in 1 year. Now, don't tell me that's not a bubble. To quote from the Bank of America survey here, quote, investors' risk-taking has hit an all-time high. A record high percentage of investors say equities are overvalued, yet cash levels are simultaneously falling, an indicator of irrational exuberance. All right, this was reported just 2 days ago. Cash balances are down to 4%, the lowest in 4 years. High-profile investors warn a pullback is coming. Okay, so even even their own research arms here are warning. Watch out, you know. And at the same time, we see more articles being written about automated trading, ETFs, passive indexing, so forth, will result in outsized market price contractions at some point. And, you know, those small investors who put their money into ETFs won't be able to get out of them. You know, they won't be able to sell them once the price starts declining. And the price will decline faster than normally because of the nature of these index funds. Right? That's why Paul Singer believes they are devouring capitalism. Yes. Capitalism devours itself. It eats itself. Wasn't there some mystical mythology character that devoured itself? I forget. Okay. Another problem is pension funds. Pension funds are trying to make up for their losses from the last crisis by taking more and more high-risk investing. One form is direct lending funds, you know, sometimes called peer-to-peer lending, shadow banks of various kinds. They've been investing heavily in these direct lending funds. But these are relatively small financial institutions, and when a contraction comes, they're going to go belly up, many of them. And people's retirement plans are now exposed to high risks in these forms of private lending for the first time. So if you think your 401k and your IRA got whacked in 2008-09, watch out next time. It'll be even more. Another indicator of financial fragility here is what's called covenants. What are covenants? Well, covenants are conditions on loans. Here we're talking about loans, not bonds. And loans, of course, are heavily relied upon by small and medium corporations and businesses. You know, the big corporations and businesses issue bonds. They don't borrow loans so much. And we'll talk about junk bonds here shortly. But covenants are conditions on which loans are made to companies who are increasingly desperate and need the loans, mostly. You might call them junk loans when there's high and you know, miscellaneous numerous covenants. Covenants say, for example, you can't take on more debt than you after this than a certain percentage of your operations, or your profits have to be maintained, or you're going to have to sell off some of your assets if it drops below a certain level. These are restrictions on the loans on those companies that take out these loans and have covenants in them. Well, the covenants are disappearing, you see. It's what's called covenant light debt. It's expanding to small, particularly to small and medium businesses. Loans are being made without conditions, because those conditions don't exist, higher risk taking is occurring. Right? It's similar to junk bonds. You see, junk bonds are bonds sold by companies that are not very financially stable. Right, very risky, and therefore they have to pay a higher interest rate on the bonds. You might call covenant-free loans junk loans, see, and there's more and more of them. being issued, particularly small, medium companies. 80% of the loans in the European Union are now covenant light. Right? This is a sign of higher risk-taking, and what it means is that companies that should be contracting and reducing and maybe going out of business are being kept alive, zombie companies, right, when they shouldn't be. So when a crisis occurs, they're really going to be gone, see. And we're seeing this kind of junk bond sell-off also beginning now. Junk bond sell-off. Junk bonds, meaning high-yield bonds, meaning companies issue bonds and have to pay a lot for it because they are high risk of survival. Junk bonds. Investors are beginning to dump these junk bonds because they don't look like a good investment anymore. They don't look like they may not get their money out. A $1.3 trillion sector here in the U.S. alone. And right now, a lot of ETFs, exchange-traded funds, are written on junk bonds. That's a source of contagion. You know, if the ETFs are in trouble, then it will spread to junk bonds. And if the junk bonds are in trouble, it will spread to junk bond ETFs and affect equities and stock prices. You see, this contagion is very important in these financial asset markets. By the way, on this contagion thing, General Electric, one of the biggest, for a while, the biggest, wealthiest, greatest valuation company in the U.S. and maybe in the world, is now in trouble, and it's contracting. It's kind of like a traditional corporate capitalist canary in the coal mine. For General Electric to be in trouble and have to sell off its assets and contract, this is a warning sign, because there's got to be, you know, thousands of companies behind GE here in the same condition. Same condition. Okay, so let's watch GE as well, what's going on with GE, and watch what's going on with this covenant light loans and junk bonds. Well, right now it's not a general junk bond warning situation, but it's focused in right now in telecom stocks, telecom companies, right? It looks like there's a beginning of a rout, a junk bond rout in telecoms, and that could spread, you see. So that's another warning area. China has a lot of junk bonds. They don't call them junk bonds. They're called entrusted loans, you see. It's the same thing, very similar in state-owned enterprises being kept alive when they aren't profitable at all, right? China entrusted loans, there's been a bond rout underway in entrusted loans and bonds in China, and the Central Bank of China is trying to head it off by pumping more liquidity into the market, which just, you know, fuels other speculators. But it's an example of how China tries to deal with its shadow banks and speculators, and has this increasing trouble doing so. And it's kind of a whack-a-mole, speculative finance whack-a-mole going on over there with the China government trying to do something about it. The U.S. government doesn't try to do anything about it, you see. That's the big difference between them and us. By the way, you know, if a crisis occurs in China, a financial crisis occurs in China, you know, with entrusted loans or wealth management products or local government finance vehicles or state-owned enterprises, all of those are candidates for financial instability in China. China has the resources and the kind of government control that it can respond quickly and effectively. I don't think if a financial market crisis occurs in China, it will cause a general financial crisis in China. But the fact that it occurs in China will send a psychological warning and risk-off attitude to the rest of the world. And in other words, contagion. The market will have a contagion effect elsewhere in global markets, even though China might be able to get its hands around the problem. That's kind of the process I see that might occur in China. And we'll talk about China more here in subsequent shows. And I do have chapters just on China and central bank and China's central bank and bailouts and liquidity and so forth in my just published book a couple months ago, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. That's available, you know, on Amazon or from my publisher, Clarity Press, or on my own websites. But the foundation for this latest book, of course, is my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. As it was for my analysis of the European Union and its problems in looting Greece, a new financial imperialism emerges, which was also published in 2016. Okay, so let's turn now to Bitcoin. Bitcoin. Whoa, talk about a bubble. I mean, that's not even debatable. Bitcoin prices at the beginning of this year were $2,000 per coin, and they recently hit $8,000 per coin. So what's driving Bitcoin and all the other cryptocurrencies, which are being spun off here almost daily? You know, there's hundreds of them now, and it looks like certain sectors of the global economy are embracing bitcoins, and others are saying, whoa, watch out here. Bitcoins are digital tulips. That's what I call them, digital tulips. And I'm referring to the 1640 Netherlands speculative mania, buying and selling tulip bulbs, right, which led to a financial huge bubble and crashed the whole Netherlands economy, and it took over a decade for it to recover in Netherlands. You know, Netherlands was one of the most advanced economies at the time, a major commercial trading country, rivaling Britain at the time, and even engaging in wars with sea wars with Britain over who would control these new colonies and so forth. But the matter was decided when the digital tulip bust occurred and wrecked the economy. They couldn't build ships after that and compete with Britain. Okay, so Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are digital tulips. Well, why are they so popular? Well, one of the reasons is because there's so much money out there, and it's looking for a place to go. And this is bitcoins and cryptos are really just another kind of financial engineering. You know, we have derivatives and CDOs and CDSs and ETFs and so forth. Well, bitcoins is just another place that's created. When you got all this extra liquidity and money floating around, what do finance capitalists do? They create markets, and they create financial products to trade in those markets. That's what shadow banks do, you see. And we have all these liquid financial markets globally now, and all these new kind of financial securities and assets. And Bitcoin's just one of them. Cryptos are just one of them. But there's special conditions driving you know, cryptocurrencies here. Money laundering from emerging markets. You know, a lot of it's going into cryptocurrencies here. Also, Bitcoin and cryptos are associated with this new technology innovation called blockchain trading. And that's why investors are investing in some of these software companies that have become sources for currencies that are trying to create the next generation blockchain software technology. It's going to reduce banking costs and cross-country money flows significantly. And that's why the big banks from financial institutions and credit cards and so forth are interested in blockchain. And they're investing in blockchain. Well, these software companies creating a blockchain product are also looking at the opportunity of raising money by an initial public offering of their own version of cryptocurrency. And, you know, crypto IPOs are proliferating, you know, scores of them, and they're all competing with Bitcoin. Bitcoin seems to have the lead here, but it's a Wild West market here for cryptocurrencies. By the way, cryptocurrencies are also an example of how the central banks are losing control of the money supply, right? It's a form of money being created without money. You see, it's electronic money, and it's really a situation where they are able to control the influence the supply in various ways, by creating money itself. Money, you know, is a strange thing, but very powerful. And if capitalists can't control the supply of money, they're in trouble. And that's, of course, happening because of technology. And cryptocurrencies are just an example of this. There aren't any real regulated clearinghouses for Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. There are clearinghouses, but they're not regulated, and they're popping up worldwide everywhere. And that can pose a real problem. Unregulated buying and selling of this new form of currency called cryptocurrencies, Bitcoins, can really destabilize markets, and they're worried about that. China has outlawed it, and I believe South Korea has as well. But Japan has embraced it, you see. Japan, the home of speculative finance since the 1980s, and that's why the real economy barely grows, has seen an opportunity here to try to become the center for Bitcoin and cryptocurrency clearinghouses and trading. And Britain, which is in decline financially with Brexit, is also toying with the idea, trying to fill in some of the empty banks that are going to be leaving London with global trading and cryptos, you see, trying to be the global center. It was London was the center for euro trading and other global currency trading, but now it's going to lose that designation. So it's trying to make up by jumping on this new bandwagon for these new currencies. Okay, so let's watch Bitcoin at $8,000 a coin. And it's all electronic, by the way. There are no real coins involved here. It's all electronic generated, created money, you see. And the banking system is what creates the money. And that's exactly what Bitcoin's cryptocurrencies are doing. But it's these startups that are challenging the banking system with their own forms of new money. But at the heart of it is the technology, blockchain. Okay, so those are the financial bubbles that we've been looking at. Stocks, what's driving junk bonds, what's driving bitcoins. Watch GE as an indicator, the canary in the coal mine. And irrational exuberance is back.